Got it. So, Sajeev, maybe you want to update us on, because we missed out your entire summer, more or less. So, it would be nice to hear about what you've been doing through the summer.
So what I did in the summer more or less is spend the time on building the infrastructure to automate the whole process of reallocation and collecting data and modeling. So far what I did is basically build up individual processes, what we had before, like collection of data from hosts or the models and also the algorithms. So what I did is, in terms of my preparation, is to connect all those pieces into a single driver program and basically automated the whole process.
Okay. Can you tell us what you can do right now? I mean, what can your infrastructure do?
So the infrastructure what can do is, now you can, let's say, a set of VMs are running a set of applications. So what the infrastructure can do, the infrastructure can.
So just to be clear, the VMs and workloads are launched separately. They are launched ahead of time, right? So they are running already before your infrastructure comes
The
in.
VMs are started separately, not that the applications are running. It's just the VMs are powered on,
Okay.
more or less. So what my infrastructure can do, infrastructure can start up the processes, start up the applications inside the VMs. And after the application starts running, what it does is that after a certain interval, it takes statistics from the ESXi, from the host. And also, each VM, when the application starts running, each VM reports its performance to my controller machine.
Okay. So, and this is part of the reporting is part of this infrastructure you built.
Yeah, reporting is a part of the infrastructure.
Okay.
So what is going on is that once my it's a driver in a separate machine. What the driver does is that it launches several applications inside each virtual machine, and also it started collecting data from the ESX host as well. So after a certain interval, it pauses and it collects all the data and parses those information to get the necessary data, necessary metric it needs. So once all the metric is collected, the resource allocation algorithm is invoked.
Now, it's still staying with the one. Is it like a one VM, one app?
I mean, one VM, one app? I mean,
one app per VM.
One app per VM, yes.
But you can run as many VMs as you.
Yes.
So the list of VMs, maybe the IP addresses, are provided in some sort of a file to your infrastructure.
Exactly.
And then it goes ahead and also maybe the list of executables, and it goes ahead and launches these executables within these VMs.
Yes.
And start the process of collecting the statistics from the host.
Exactly.
And how many hosts?
Right now, I have a couple of hosts. Couple of physical hosts, yeah.
Okay. And once you, let's say, you were saying something about collecting statistics after a period of time, right? So what is that about? And what do you do with that information?
Once I get this information, I calculate what the information means. So the first you need to get the information of the performance, the application performance metric of each VM. So I parse that information also. Also, I get the VM latency information from the ESX host. So these are the information which needs to be collected at a certain interval. Once I get that information, what I do is that I convert those application performance metric into revenue. So that's also a separate function, which is basically the SLA. So I call that SLA function to convert it to revenue, and I calculate the collected sum of all the revenues collected.
Mm-hmm.
So once I get the statistics, I invoke the resource allocation algorithm, the greedy algorithm. So the greedy algorithm takes those information of the current result, and also like once we get this information, I call the application performance models of each individual app. So what the application performance model does, it predicts like, okay, if I increase the allocation of certain VM by a small amount, let's say 100 megahertz or 64 megabytes, what would be the predicted performance? So the performance model are used to predict those results. So once they calculate those predictions, everything is fed into the algorithm. An algorithm runs through that list of predictions and makes the arrangement which is the best in this possible case. And it recommends the new allocation in a separate file.
Does this Ajay?
I was saying that in this case you're assuming that the models are already pre-built initially, and that's just an input to the algorithm.
Yes.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. What I was going to ask is, I remember that our algorithm had this ability to change multiple delta amounts.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So are you talking about all of that change and the outcome of all of those changes?
Yes.
Is that what you're sort of simplifying here, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So your algorithm goes through many different change combinations,
yes,
and then comes up with, let's say, the next allocation that can be made without significantly affecting I/O latencies.
Yes. Right?
So the reason we don't allow a significant change in resource allocations because we do not want to significantly impact I/O latencies.
That's right.
If we do that, then our predictions might actually be incorrect. Right? So
yeah.
that's what you're doing here. Okay, so now you've gone through one such iteration of collecting performance data, collecting I/O latency, and you already have the allocations that you made to the CPU and memory allocations. You run through the resource allocation algorithm. It gives you the next set of resource allocations for CPU and memory.
Yeah.
That needs to be done. And then what do you do?
So once the algorithm exists with those suggestions, so what the driver program picks up, and it executes those suggestions.
Hmm. Okay.
So once the execution is over, so I let the application run for again a certain interval between 5 to 10 minutes.
The same interval as before, right?
As before, yes. 5 to 10 minutes.
Hmm.
And then reiterate the whole process. So we go back again to collection of VM latency, collection of performance, and we check, okay, how much the collective revenue has changed so far.
Hmm.
If the net change is greater than zero or greater than some amount, some positive amount, we continue the whole process, otherwise we stop there.
And just to clarify one more thing, when you say that you will set the new controls, you're basically setting reservation equal to limit equal to the new value that you compute.
Exactly. I mean, everything I'm talking about in terms of resource allocation to the VM is the reservation and limit are equal.
And when you're setting this, it's possible that the control may fail on a host, so you are going through DRS to do the handling of the control.
Yes, but that is not handled explicitly. That's the part of the DRS, and I'm trusting DRS to execute that part.
Yeah. I mean, as long as there is enough resources available on other hosts, if you change the reservation of the VM, if it cannot be satisfied on the existing host, it would get moved to another host.
Yes. That's correct.
So this resource allocation algorithm already has information about how much resources there are in the there is in the system, right? Does the resource allocation algorithm know that?
I mean, the whole driver knows that, but the allocation algorithm doesn't know all those things.
Right. So the driver does it ensure that the new resources that you suggestions that you come up with are satisfiable or not?
It's already checked in. I mean, that condition I don't need to check explicitly.
Okay.
I already made sure that there are enough resources to satisfy the collective.
So you do that manually, or is this part of the infrastructure?
I do that manually. But what Ajay is mentioning, that maybe the resource, because the resource pool, remember that concept of resource pool, which may be greater than a physical host.
Okay.
So the resource pool, what I do in my driver program is I say that, okay, the total CPU of the resource pool should be something like that. Let's say 32 gigahertz. But the machine has only 20 gigahertz, a particular one host.
Mm-hmm.
So what in that case is do is that it just moves VM from one host to another.
Right.
But that goes on transparently. So my program doesn't, my driver doesn't force it explicitly.
Okay, so your driver program, as you call it, has information about the capacity of the resource pool.
Yes.
Which is, in your case, right now, whatever you're doing is with two hosts, so the combined capacity of both these hosts.
Yes.
Okay.
But the movement decision should be given by your driver, right?
No, the decision happens transparently. You don't be, because that's the part of the DRS. I'm not forcing one VM to move from one host to another host.
Okay.
I think what the driver program, if I understand correctly, is just comes up with new values for CPU reservation and memory reservation, right, and limit. In your case,
the driver program?
The driver program for each VM.
Yes.
That's what it does. And mm-hmm. then it gives all this information to DRS, which then figures out how to implement those reservations.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think a very simple way to think about it is that essentially what DRS is giving you is the abstraction of a single giant host, which has the CPU and memory capacity of all the hosts in your cluster. And you can basically think of one host and put your VM, and it will try to take care of moving VMs around to respective settings. Now, obviously, there is an issue of fragmentation here.
Yeah.
That if you reserve the full cluster, then it's possible that DRS would start failing because it won't be able to move VMs around. So I would say once you start running experiments, just make sure that you are not reserving the full cluster.
Mm.
You are reserving up to some 90% of the capacity or something.
Yeah,
and that's actually one of the comments I was going to make when you are setting reservation equal to limit. Because you are essentially setting reservation for every resource in the cluster, which makes it very hard to do vMotion round.
I think at this level, those are not a necessary concern because my capacity is way beyond the number of VMs the amount of resources I'm consuming. So.
But I think eventually when you run, let's say, 50 VMs or something
yeah,
like
that. Yeah,
that
will be a problem.
Then these would become issues that
yes.
you need to be careful about. Okay. All right. So.
Yeah. And I think ideally it would also be nice from the system point of view that you set a reservation to be the certain value that you want and you set limit to be maybe 5 or 10% higher so that there is at least some headroom and then overall there is some unreserved capacity in the cluster also.
Okay, I think that's a good idea.
Hmm. Okay, so that's good. So tell us, given that it seems like you've achieved quite a bit, so you've not been idling during the summer. Tell us what are you confident about running experiments and and getting data, or I mean, what have you done so far in terms of testing?
So in terms of testing, now I'm running the beta, so the actual experiment I'm running.
Mm.
So far what I've encountered, the problem is because of the modeling is becoming an issue here.
Mm.
I think last time we discussed about that, so I want to elaborate on that. So remember that my algorithm, like the resource reallocation algorithm, what it does is that given a performance and given a current allocation, so it predicts, like, let's say one VM is running an application and the current CPU may be 400 megahertz and the current memory is 400 megabyte as well. So what it does is that it predicts, like, let's say if I change the CPU from 400 to 500 and also 400 to 600, like, what would the performance will look like? So that's the information the algorithm needs to figure out what is the best reallocation decision. So what's happening, what I saw in the actual experiment, as I told Raju before, but I want to tell others too, is that remember that the models I built was, I'm using the same model as I used in my my last paper. So in that case, what we did is basically run one VM in the one application in a one VM, and and another VM was used to simulate the contention, basically. Yes, to control the I/O contention.
Yeah, I think that's important. I think we are only simulating I/O contention then.
Yes.
Right. And I feel personally that, anyway, you should continue and then.
So what we did is that we simulate the I/O contention from another VM, but we haven't considered the CPU cache contention and all those things. So what I observed here is that as I increase the number of VMs, let's say from 5 to 10, the performance I'm observing is a little bit lower than what I saw before when I ran the VM individually.
Right. And here, I think it's important to point out that it's not just that you're running VMs and they're not doing anything. They're running workloads.
Yes.
Some significant workloads.
Significant workloads, yeah.
Whereas earlier, we were only running I/O meter or something. I don't know what it is. That
FIO.
FIO, right. So for just simulating I/O contention, which is not very CPU intensive or cache intensive.
Mm-hmm.
So now, because we have a lot more workloads that are contending on some of those shared resources like caches, you don't see the same kind of performance that you saw before. And
yes.
It's actually lower than that in most cases.
It's actually lower.
Mm, in all cases.
And how much deviation is it?
It's like 10 to 20, 30% deviation.
And what's the overall utilization of the host itself? I mean, what is the CPU utilization of the host?
So these are all benchmarks that do not have any idle time, right? They generate continuous
work. Yes.
So the only time they would, you know, the CPU utilization would be less than 100% is if there is blocking due to I/O, right? So did you look at what Ajay is asking for, the utilization numbers?
I don't remember the whole utilization number from the host perspective, but as I recall, like, it's not that much. I mean, it's reasonably low because I am not saturating the host yet. I mean, it's only 10 VMs running in a very large host. I mean, so.
But is it less than 60% or more than 60%?
No, it is less than 60%.
What benchmark did you run?
I'm running FileBench.
I mean, I think one thing is true that if once you start running the overall host at a utilization of maybe 75-80%, you are just trying to put more load on the CPU and overall latencies would be slightly higher. But if the host is utilized at less than 60%, I feel that at least there is no host level resource constraint. I agree that there might be some cache contention and things like that. But it's surprising that you are seeing 30% degradation just with that.
Yeah. So, I mean, is that 30% uniform or is more
no,
variable?
It's 15 to 30%.
15.
Around 15-30%.
Okay.
But it's not consistent all the time. But there are drops from the before.
Okay.
I see. Are you seeing any ready time on the CPU for the VM? So
I haven't
there is a
that.
Stack called ready time that tells you if the VM CPU had to wait for somebody else to before it runs on the CPU. If there is no ready time, then at least it makes sure that there is no CPU contention from other VMs.
I'll check that, but I haven't checked that metric yet.
How many cores do you have on this machine? 12, I think.
12.
12 cores, and you have 10 VMs.
Yes.
Okay. I'm assuming that you have only one, well, you could have multiple threads of each of those workloads, right?
Yeah.
So each VM is only giving one VCPU.
Yeah.
So it's a bit
of a mess. Oh, it's just one VCPU per VM?
Mm-hmm.
I see. Okay, so then there should be no CPU contention. Because you have more CPUs than VMs.
Is the hardware virtualization enabled?
No. There's no hardware virtualization.
I see. I mean, another thing that you can try, although it may not make as much difference, you can try to pin one VM to one core.
If I use DRS, that doesn't work actually.
Yeah, actually, if you pin the VM to the core, the vMotion will not be enabled.
Yeah, that actually gives me a DRS violation or something like that.
That's true. Because I think if you start pinning, then vMotion won't work, and then DRS cannot move the VM
exactly.
to another host. Okay, but I think just for experimental case, it will be good to check if pinning makes a big difference. Because the only thing that it disables is that you cannot vMotion it out.
Mm-hmm.
But for the first cut, you may not be worried about vMotion if your host has enough capacity.
Right. But I feel, Ajay, that if the number of VMs are smaller than the number of cores, there is no reason for the VM to not be pinned by default, right?
Yeah, I think by default, CPU scheduler should take care of that. I think it's just to see if that changes the performance,
if
and in that case, we have actually discovered an issue with the CPU scheduler.
Right.
Pretty much.
I think on these machines, Ming, you probably know more about this. We have two chips with six cores each, right?
Two processors
with six cores each, and each of these processors have a shared L3 cache, perhaps.
Yeah.
So that's being contended upon.
Mm-hmm. If you could try put say six virtual machines on the same processor. And then
same processor.
Yes. In another experiment, you just put one on one processor and five on the other processor.
And see what happens. Yeah, I think that would be good. So I think to expand on that, let's say you have seven VMs. Okay, instead of running 10 VMs, run seven VMs, put six on one core. Six on one of the processors and one on a separate processor, so it doesn't share any of the caches, right, with the other guys, and see if there is any difference in the performance, in the prediction accuracy of the first six guys versus the actual performance you see, right, and the accuracy of your predictions. I think these are the things that you should try to understand the problem a little bit deeper.
Okay.
So that's a good suggestion.
What I did try, I mean, I didn't try multiple runs, but what I did try once is that just to keep one, because right now all my VMs are by default on the single host.
Hmm.
So what I did is that moved one host to move one VM to another host. I run the same experiments and see that if that particular VM has a different performance with the set of nine VMs. And at least for one run, I see that performance is quite high than the rest of the nine VMs, although I'm running the same workload, same resource allocation.
Okay, the same thing that we were just suggesting. You just move the VM out of the machine itself. Moving it to a different processor will ensure that the VM shares things other than what's on the processor. Right, and see if that is causing contention. If you move it out to a separate host, then we are eliminating all possible sources of contention. Right. Except IO. Right. So, and IO contention, we already know that, you know.
But the thing is that also I noticed that when I move out to another, completely another host, the observed IO latency for that particular VM is also low.
Is lower.
Lower.
Oh, interesting. So there is some queuing inside the host itself that is perhaps magnifying the IO latency when co-located with other VMs in the same host.
Mm, yeah.
So Ajay, you probably know a lot more about this. So IO latency is a sum of IO latency at the storage, shared storage, plus IO latency inside the hypervisor, right?
True. But I think that you should be able to easily monitor using some stats. So there are two numbers that we report. One is called as D average, another one is called as K average, which is basically the device latency plus kernel queuing latency.
Kernel
and
queuing hypervisor.
In most cases, the kernel queuing should be zero. And I don't know what you are using as a storage backend, but typically the least amount of IOs that we keep pending on the backend is, I think, 32 by default. So as long as you have less than 32 outstanding IOs from the VMs, the kernel queuing should be zero.
You mean 32 in total across all the VMs?
Across all the VMs,
yes.
For a single
host
shared device.
It could be more than 32 because if you're running FIO across multiple VMs. No,
so first I think you should check the K-average number, which is easily there on ESXSOP. If you run ESXSOP, it will tell you if there is any kernel queuing going on.
Hmm.
Second, you can increase that number. It's a driver level option. You might have to reboot the host, but you can bump up the number to 64 or 128.
Okay, so to push more IOs to the device.
Yeah.
Hmm. That might equalize the latency across different VMs in different hosts.
Mm-hmm. And are you using a shared storage, or how are you using storage in your setup?
Yeah, it's a shared storage. It's a NFS storage.
Okay. Actually, on NFS, the number should already be higher. The number that I was telling was for
single disk
fiber channel. No. Basically, for the actual block-based LUNs. For NFS, I think the number is much higher as it is. It should not be doing any kernel queuing at all.
It's like 128, right? 128 around, right? I think
it's probably 256 even.
Okay.
Hmm.
So NFS should not be a problem at all. I mean, the reason these numbers are there on the other side is because the HPA drivers, they put these caps on the LUN base. So if you're using QLogic or Emulex HPA, they put a number of 32. And now we are stuck behind 32. And that's actually a number that I have been trying to get bigger. And I think in the latest release, the number became 64 for some of them. But for NFS, there was no such limit as it is, because there is nobody enforcing number of IOs, or there is no such thing as NFS driver. It's just regular TCP.
Hmm. Okay. So there are two things here, right, Sajeev? One is that you see a higher performance when you move the VM out to its own host, right? But also, in terms of your prediction accuracy, do things change? Because I think the concern that existed before was your prediction accuracy was off by 30%, 15 to 30%. So if you move it to another host with no contention at the host level, do you see your prediction accuracy improving?
Yeah.
You do?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So there is...
So I think...
Yeah, sorry, go ahead, Ajay.
I was saying, I think the high-level problem that we are seeing here is that it's hard to work off of an offline model. It seems to me that we can start with the offline model, but the model should be able to update itself based on some online data. Mm. And I feel no matter how we skin it, ultimately that may be the fundamental problem, that we have to make the model adaptive to the online information.
So, Sajeev, we talked about some direction. It was not the same as creating an online model, but something that sort of allows for us to still use the offline model, right?
Yes.
But maybe not in the best possible way. So I think it would be good to discuss that now.
I think what Raju suggested last time we discussed is that because in my algorithm, my algorithm looks at the difference in performance. Like if I change from 400 to 500 megahertz, so what it needs is that it needs to know that how much performance gain is required. So what I'm using here, I'm using the observed performance as my base to calculate the differences. So what Raju suggested that instead of use observed performance, also as a base case, use the predicted performance.
I think you might have to expand a bit more. It's a little bit too...
So let me explain it in a better way. So
you want to maybe draw something on the board? And I can switch on video here. Unfortunately, Kaushik...
I think I can explain.
Okay.
So think about that the current allocation of a CPU allocation of a particular VM is 400 megahertz, and we got performance like 16 IOPS or 16 operations per second for a file bench workload.
Mm.
So what my algorithm needs to know is that if I change from 400 to 500 megahertz, let's say, how much performance gain it will have. So how do I calculate this change? So what I can do is that I use the model to predict, like let's say, and the model says that under 500 megahertz, the performance will be, let's say 18 ops per second. So
maybe more than 16, right?
More than 16. So 18 per second. So what I can do is that, so what I had, what the algorithm needs is that the difference between 18 and 16. So basically, it is 2 ops per second. But this is not be the base case because my model can say, okay,
there is some error in your prediction accuracy.
There is some error in my prediction accuracy. So what you can do in that case is that instead of using 16 operations per second, which is actually the observed, I mean, what we observed by running the experiment.
Before the change,
what we can do is that instead feed 400 megahertz to the model to predict it itself.
Right.
So the model might say, oh, it's not 16, it's 14. So
but it would actually be reversed, given that most of your predictions are lower than what your most of your observed values are lower than what the predicted values are.
Yeah.
So let's say that the predicted value at 400 is 16 and the observed is 14.
Yeah.
Right. And then afterwards, when you ask for what is the performance going to be at 500, the model tells you 18.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But then when you run it at 500, you see it's only 16. So what that means is that your model at 400 predicted 16, and your model at 500 predicts 18, but what you observe is 14 and 16 respectively.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So what do we do now? So how do we use this?
I mean, instead of using the current result to calculate the predicted gains, we always trust the model. So that's one approach.
Yeah.
Because we are all
that's sort of a lame approach, but it makes things a little better, right?
It makes things a little better in the sense that I don't know. I mean, I have to run real experiments to see.
Okay,
that
you haven't done that.
Yeah. So, but thing is that we are always working on the relative gain and relative loss, so we should be fine.
Assuming that our predictions are always off by some constant value, and then
the predictions are following a trend.
Right.
It's always
actually lower. That's true. That's even weaker than always a constant value. It's just the predictions need to have the same trend as the observed.
Yeah. If the observed gets more than the predicted, then it's a problem.
No. Okay. I think what you said earlier was making more sense. If the predicted values have the same trend as the observed values,
mm-hmm.
then we could just work off the predicted values.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps in the end achieve the same result as working off the observed and predicted with perfect accuracy.
Yeah.
So that's the thinking here.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the most satisfying way to deal with this problem, but it seems like one way. So I think it would be good to hear what others think about this. Well, first of all, does it make any sense that what we just
discussed?
It makes sense, but it sounds heuristic.
It's a heuristic, yeah.
Yes.
But I'm guessing that people might have done something similar before, right? It's not...
But remember, like in terms of revenue, we are not trusting the model. In terms of revenue calculation, we are always trusting the actual data. So if we can show that our collective revenue is actually improving, so it's not a bad thing.
What is preventing you from using the observed data to update your model?
Update my model?
Yes.
It's not easy. I mean, I don't know how to do that.
I mean, you had previous data points from which you constructed the model. Now you have a new data point. Is it hard to add to the previous data point and then redo the model?
I mean, at the data as I see now, I mean, and just...
Yeah, basically every few minutes you take the sample points that you have for those minutes. Let's say for 5 minutes you have 15 sample points, you basically throw it in the model and you recompute it. I almost feel that it's going to be hard to sell that a single model that you have pre-computed works all the time.
Yeah. Well, the single model, we are not using it to predict accurately the... So just to clarify this hack we are talking about, right, because it's basically that it's a hack to make an offline model work in an online scenario, is we are not using the predicted values directly. We are actually using it indirectly, maybe with two levels of indirection, right? And the basic property that we are looking for here is that the predicted value trends similarly to the observed values. And if that happens, then that's good enough for this sort of a hack to work.
But I mean, if that is good enough as a condition, then why do we need the model at all? We can just assume that as you give more resources, the performance would get better, and it's in the same direction. Because the slope is not mattering anymore.
The thing is that
how fast or how slow.
I think the problem is that there are... there are even in the trends there are lines where or regions where you don't have any gain, right? And regions below which you have significantly worse performance if you make a small change. I think those are what we are using the models for. But you're right that if there is a gap between what we see in the observed trends in that regard, then this hack doesn't really work, right? For those portions of the space, right, where the trends not just in terms of whether it's in the same direction, but also the slope of these two trend lines, they cannot be completely different, right? So yeah, I agree. And of course, in the worst case, we might have completely different trends altogether, right? That the observed actually goes down when our predicted values indicate otherwise. Yeah. So, let's see.
Even the online update will be error, because the PMs are moving across the machines. So whatever because one PM performance will be dependent on the characteristics of the other PM, and if the other PM moves away from this machine to another machine and a new characteristic comes up on this machine, then you cannot pay, that may affect whatever you're predicting.
I I think the I mean training the model online can be done. I mean, we could just throw more data points at our SVM or whatever it is that the sub modeling technique we are using.
We're using the ANN now. I'm using the ANN now.
ANN sub modeling,
mm-hmm.
Right? We could try that and see what happens. What is the outcome of that? Because what we are doing is not a snapshot of the model. The model itself is being constructed in an online fashion, and it is never representative of any specific state at some point in time, right? It's a combination of states that have been observed as contention has changed, right? So I don't know how the ANN will respond to that. It's not clear.
But I think from my experience, if you continue feeding more data, kind of the error prediction goes high.
Hmm. Right. I think with respect to the hack also, I mean, our assumption that the trend lines should move in the same direction, right? The predicted and observed should move in the same direction. And if they do, that's the assumption we are making here, that they do. And if they don't, we can observe that
yeah.
they don't.
Yeah.
And if they don't, what do? We need to have sort of a fallback way to deal with. Maybe we should just at that point stop making changes and say, okay, we've reached some stable point. But I don't know why that is the conclusion. We might
but
have
you're
to.
Making the delta to the resources.
Yes, we are making delta changes to the resources.
If you are making the delta changes, maybe the error difference that you get in one step can be adjusted into the next step.
I mean, we can just revert.
So you're saying instead of changing the model itself, let's say that we use the error distribution, the dynamic error distribution, and compensate for it in our predictions.
Yeah, as you go kind of things.
Yeah, I think that's another point in the...
I think we discussed that. Though.
Yeah, we discussed that. And what was the... I think that was also a reasonable option. But then we decided to go with this other hack.
Yeah. Things that the drop in percentage error may not be the same in the another run. So that was a problem.
So that the inaccuracy itself might be changing.
Now what is more inaccurate, or we have to look at which is least inaccurate, maybe. That's the one way to go. So if we can just multiply the number by a certain value, whatever I'm getting, depending on certain observations, and if it's well enough within some inaccuracy, then it's okay.
Yeah, I think both of these are hacks. We can show that, well, if we have data to say that, okay, these hacks seem to work, I think that's fine. But it's hard to defend it more scientifically.
And also, I think Sajid mentioned that the error seems to grow when we are adding more points online. Is it because we are trying to still evaluate using the older data points?
Oh, yeah. Because the newer points only replace very few of the existing points, right? Because there are a whole bunch of points that we had before. We cannot throw all of them out because we need... a minimum number of points to span the entire parameter space for the ANN to deliver something useful, right?
Mm-hmm.
True, but then my question is that why is error seems to be increasing? Is it because we are still trying to fit better to the older points as much as possible?
I mean, if you keep feeding like this around, let's say, let's say I have points around 400 megahertz and 600 megabytes, and you keep and let's say I built a model before and with some data, but I keep observing new data and feed into that. So, but if I keep feeding like more data, then the old data will be erased somehow. Somehow NN will ignore that as a noise. But if there are just few data around that point, then NN will be completely confused.
I think what Ajay was suggesting is to actually remove the old data and replace it. So when you train the ANN, you can control what data to use for the training set, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you have new data that contradicts existing data, remove the other older data, put the new, and then whatever is not contradicted, you leave it as it is and create a new model. Is that a good way to characterize what you're describing, Ajay?
Sort of, yeah. I think I was also trying to understand that is the error increasing because as we are adding more points, we still expect the model to fit older points as well as new points, but obviously it's not going to fit both of them.
Exactly.
It's only going to fit one of the two, or it will be somewhere in between.
Exactly.
But the point is, if the new data is not noise, it's representative of the current behavior, it should steer your model towards the right direction to give you higher accuracy, unless the new data is noise. If the new data is noise, then of course you have overfitting it, you make your model more sensitive, and that will lower your prediction accuracy. So it depends on which data situation is.
And removing the older data is also a good point that we should consider if we want to do the online update.
Then why the boy build the model in the first case, right?
We have everything online.
Oh, no, you need the model to...
The thing is, you need trend, right?
You need trend, because if you just have, let's say, one point in the space, you don't know, for instance, what happens when I increase the resource or reduce the resource, you don't have that.
The thing is that will be hard to implement this automatically, that sort
of thing. So automated retraining of the model,
yes.
Removing existing data, replacing it with some new data, and retraining it.
What's the difficulty?
Things that the numbers are not same, so I need to like classify the boundaries in each case and
so you're saying there is some manual effort involved. It's not completely automated the way we describe it in the paper.
Maybe we can start with a basic model which is trained offline.
Yeah, even with the basic model, but I need to say because the online number could be anything. So let's say CPU number could be anything, memory number could be anything. So I have to look for like which is the nearest point around this number.
I think that's not the right way, by the way. If you want to do this online, you need to implement that automation that you describe in the paper. I think that would be the right way. The automated discovery of where the boundaries are and where the clusters are and so on, and mapping of those clusters to the resource level.
I think for reasonable accuracy, we don't need to use clusters, for example.
So you're saying sub-modeling is not necessary?
It's not necessary. And for to improve, like, excellent, like, we want, like, 3% median error or something like that, it's okay. But to just to get a trend, just to get a good trend, it's only a single model is enough.
Okay.
For the most of the workloads. Because remember, we need sub-modeling because as I looked into my data, in most of the cases, sub-modeling got helpful because of those boundary regions, like under high resource constraint or extremely resource, like full of resource. So in those conditions, sub-modeling becomes helpful. But under a reasonable region, it's the same thing.
Oh, I see. So you're saying that you could create the sub-model boundaries offline.
Yes.
And then only manipulate the sub-models themselves. So you don't have to repartition and create new sub-models.
No, just use
existing
sub-models.
Okay. Okay, so then it would seem... Oh. Hello?
Sorry.
Yeah. So then it would seem to be doable, right? I mean, if your data only affects one of the sub-models, retain that sub-model and reuse the...
Retrieve some old data.
Yeah.
Now, how do we find the old data? Like the closest match?
But don't you already have the training points that you used, let's say, for the previous iteration?
Yes.
Because now you're talking about training the sub models every iteration, right?
Oh, okay.
Right, every iteration you have new training points. You have the previous ones. Now that you have new training points, you can map them to what needs to be invalidated in the previous set. So you start with some set that you build using the offline, right?
Yes.
And then you keep updating those sets of training points.
Yeah, but still I need to somehow find the close points or something like that.
Yeah, you would have to find out within a certain region which are the points that perhaps...
That point should be thrown away in the next...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, that might work. Yeah. You have timestamps for their points. So where we have potential points, you throw away all these data points.
So I need to associate with the timestamp as well.
Yes. Of course, you do something.
No, I think what data needs to go away is the data that this new data would replace,
yeah.
Right? But not based on the timestamp.
Yeah, but say you have a number of points that you can continue to replace. Which one to choose?
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
I see.
Of course, the oldest one would be the worst. Yeah.
Okay, I see. So you're talking about the candidates to be replaced.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that is a more scientific approach.
Yeah,
yeah. I think what we discussed last week was really based on an assumption that this constructing this online model is not easy, right? It would be very hard. But I think based on today's discussions, I actually don't feel that anymore. At least I think it's worth a try to see what happens with this online updating of submodels, and given that we are not talking about redoing the submodel boundaries, so in some sense we have sort of this coarse-grained offline model.
Yeah, and I think there are actually existing papers that talk about updating the models online, and maybe we should look at some of them to see what techniques they are using to update their models.
Hmm.
I think almost all the papers from SP Labs that I know, they basically go with this online update. And my thinking is that that's exactly the reason they went with it, because they realized that what you create offline is not going to be good enough in practice once you start running in real systems.
Hmm. Right. And so Ajay, just to get more out of what you read in the HP papers, these are mostly for CPU allocation, right? Or do they?
I think most of them focus on CPU and memory.
And memory.
Some of them do IO too.
So then we would have to carefully look at what they've done and make sure that we don't repeat.
I think I have to take a different approach, because most of the HP papers they use control theory. Because by nature, you can update it.
Mm-hmm.
Just by simple control theory equations.
Not necessarily. It depends on how they use the control theory to build a controller. Some of them, they also use a model. Use a model to build a relationship between input and output. And use a model to create a controller. Then slightly many of them do use a model. Yeah, but maybe a simpler model, just a linear model.
What Ming is saying, I agree with that. I think they also use a model, and they update the model, and then they apply that in their system. And I think their model may not be based on ANN. Their model may be based on some control theory approach.
I don't think they use ANN. But you should talk to Lishi, because all of her work is online. She's not using ANN. She's using Fuzzy Mountain Cutter.
It should be the same.
Yeah, but you can get part of it. But she's implementation is not MATLAB. But I guess it could be similar. Because you are using R. Right?